Yalla, let's get this show on the road. Hello, salam alaikum, shalom aleichem. How is everybody? Yeah, last time we spoke, we didn't know who would win the election, but we do now. Thanksgiving is going to be so much more meaningful this year. I'm a very happy camper, as you can tell. Anyway, before we get to my amazing guest this week, just a reminder, please help me keep this show chugging along. Go to my website, amikaufman.com. Press the donate link and all the instructions are there. It's easy, it's safe, and it's, you know, super fun to give me your money. Okay, so my guest this week is probably the busiest reporter in Israel based on the amount and pace of scoops that he publishes. Barak Ravid is probably the most well-known diplomatic correspondent in Israel these days. He worked for years in Israel's leading broadsheet, Haaretz, then moved to TV until he got fired for reasons we'll discuss in our chat. He now works in two news organizations, Walla News here in Israel, and one of my favorite websites in the U.S., Axios.com. Not many people know the Mideast political and diplomatic arena like Barak does, and we get to talk about that, about media in Israel, about Trump's legacy and Biden's challenges, and a very honest answer to the podcast question about what should be between the river and the sea. So, without further ado, here's me and Barak Ravid. It's good to see you, man. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. Actually, I'm very good.
Yeah. I mean, how's this whole how's the pandemic been treating you? I mean, sometimes some of the guests that answer that question, they actually say to me, you know what? There are some pluses to this thing. You know, I get to spend a lot more time with my family. It's not that bad.
Look, I can relate to that. I can definitely relate. The only thing is that my wife is a doctor. And so for her, it was, much more, it affected her life in a much more meaningful way, both working at the hospital and which had a lot of challenges, both on the administrative side and on the clinical side. And in the last,
I mean, it's kind of scary, isn't it? It's a little frightening. At the beginning, I think a lot of people that worked in hospitals.
Yeah, at the beginning, it was very scary. You know, over time, I think we realized that it's there are precautions that if you take, then there's no risk. But now, in the last 3 months, she's working at the Ministry of Health in Jerusalem, and this is really the battleground where, you know, the policy is being taken and drafted, and it's pretty excruciating work and long hours. So for me, it's mainly the main significance is that I had to take over almost the entire family business.
And be a full-time reporter at the same time.
Yeah,
yeah. Not easy.
In two media outlets.
Oh my God. So you said your wife's a doctor and you're living, are you in Tel Aviv?
Yeah, I'm in Tel Aviv. I'm based in Tel Aviv.
And how many kids you got?
Two kids. Six-year-old and a nine-year-old.
And are they doing the Zoom thing, or is six too young still for...
Yeah, now they're back in school. They did the Zoom thing for a while, for a little over a month. They went nuts, especially the six-year-old who's in first grade. And, you know, to put first graders on Zoom, it's not, you know, the most useful way to teach them stuff. luckily he already knows how to read and write. So I wasn't really, I wasn't very concerned. You know, I said, you know, whatever.
It's, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. But the social, I mean, socially, I think he was more, you know, he was more frustrated that he didn't see his friends, that, you know, he can't go out of the house. And so it was.
Yeah, it's hard. Very different. I mean, mine are a little older. They're 11 and 13, and they're still kind of stuck at home most of the time. They're just starting to, like, trickle back a few days into school. And it's been, like you said, socially has been, I think, really,
this
really
is
challenging.
The most difficult age, that, you know, between the fifth grade and the 12th grade, that, you know, they're just, they have nothing to do. They're stuck at home. It's a problem.
Well, speaking about childhood, you didn't grow up in Tel Aviv. I think you grew up in Kfar Saba, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Kfar Saba, which is...
What did your parents do in...
My parents still live in Kfar Saba. They still live in Kfar
okay.
Saba.
What do they do?
They, you know, they're retired. And I don't know how many of our listeners are aware, Kfar Saba is 20 minutes north of Tel Aviv and 20 years back in time.
You have to explain that. You have to tell me why you said that.
That's the, you know, that's my opinion, at least. You know, I always speak to friends, when I speak to friends in America, so for them, 20 minutes drive is like, okay, from DuPont Circle in Washington to Adams Morgan. That's, you know, that's more or less what they're talking about. Or from, you know, the Upper West Side to Soho. Okay, something like that. So to explain to someone what it means, that it's really a different world. It's really, it's really, it's not even living in the suburbs, but it's living in the suburbs in a totally different state of mind. And again, for someone who didn't grow up in Israel or doesn't live in Israel, it's hard to understand how such a small country has so many different geographical communities that are very different than each other.
I completely agree with you, because I lived in Kfar Saba for about 2.5 or 3 years. And I had a cafe there. You know, one of those ventures, a lot of journalists like me try to leave journalism every once in a while and do something else. So
which
I had a cafe.
I wasn't aware of it.
It was in the, you know, the Aharoni Center, Aharoni. I had a cafe there next to the McDonald's. It had the very unique name of coffee shop. It was a franchise, but I won't get into it. But I completely agree with your the way you label and describe Kfar Saba. But if just one more question about, you know, growing up there, and the journalist that you are now, was journalism something that was that interested you? In your early, you know, before the army and high school, or you thought about it?
It would sound like a cliche and like I'm making this up, but I swear to God that what I'm telling you now is completely true. When I was, I think it was the 10th grade or 11th or yeah, when I was in fifth grade, I went to this like extracurricular courses in the Tel Aviv University. My mom would drive me there twice a week. And one of the courses I took back then was journalism in fifth grade. And I remember that, and it was all like fifth graders, sixth graders, those were the kids. And I remember that the guy who gave us the course said that when he said how do you decide what's something worth reporting, so, and then he said, I remember it to this day, he said it needs to also be something sexy, and I remember I was in fifth grade and I didn't know what does it even mean. What does it mean, something sexy? I really couldn't. And you know, when I go back and reflect about it, I said to myself, why did he think that if he will tell fifth graders that they need to, you know, report something sexy, they would understand what he means? So this was the beginning of
this is before puberty. He's telling prepubescent people
exactly
to make an item sexy.
Exactly. And then when I was when I was in the IDF, I served in military intelligence, and I was an officer, and I served for 6 years.
Well, you served in, I have to say, you served in this very elite unit called 8200. It's a very well-known unit. It's like the top of its league, and I guess in the intelligence wing.
Yes, yes. Although I don't like when people say that it's an elite unit. You know, there are thousands of people who serve there, and I think that half of the country was already served there. So, you know, you know, at a certain point, something stops being an elite unit and just becomes everybody. You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And really, so again, very good people go there, and I it was a great experience those 6 years, and I was on the verge of staying for a career, for a military career. You know, maybe if you want, we can talk about it later. But in any case, in one of my several months before I left the army, when my commander invited me for a meeting to ask me if I want to go to the university in a special program by the military, and he asked me, what do you want to do? So I told him, listen, I'm not sure that I want to stay in the military. He said, why not? What's your plan? What do you want to do in 10 years? So I told him, listen, one of my ideas is that in 10 years I want to be this guy on television on Friday night that the anchor asks him, what's your headline for tonight? And then I give the most, the biggest scoop in the Israeli press. And he, when I moved to television a few years ago, he called me and he said, I remember this conversation we had, and it took you 12 years, not 10 years, but you made it.
Yeah, you did it. You did it. Amazing. You know, you talked about A200 and that unit and how so many people are in it, basically. I know that a lot of people also from that unit, you know, the alumni go into high tech, you know, and make a lot of money, become rich. Was high tech ever something that like you were thinking about towards the end of your military career?
If it was, then my current occupation is even, you know, that my decision made, you need to even, you know, further think about the way I make decisions. Okay. But, you know, no, it wasn't, I didn't think about it at all. I was totally unaware of this. And this is why when I go to the, every year, there are those conferences of, you know, the veterans of A200, and it's like a huge networking conference of people in high tech. And I come there every year to find myself with a group of another four people that they give us. There's always like this small place in the corner, in the back of the room, of those who are in public, they call it public, public jobs. Okay. That are not, you know, not in high tech. And so there are like 2000 people, coming to do networking on high tech, and the four of us,
and the four of you,
one of them is the mayor of Lod, the other is a professor in the university, and the other one works for the Tel Aviv municipality. But that's about it.
We're like four people. That's you. One last question about A200 that I just remembered, because there was this story a few years ago, correct me if I'm wrong, of about, I don't know, there was this letter, 40 or 50 refuseniks who were going to stop, I think, serving in the unit, you know, reservists, because of the Israeli occupation of Palestinians. Where did you, I mean, first of all, were these people that you knew personally, and where did you stand on that issue?
Look, I knew some of them. Most of the people who signed this petition were not even dealing with either the Palestinian issue or even in positions that had to do with the things that they protested on. So, you know, that I had a problem. This was my first problem, that, you know, if it's something that you didn't do personally, but somebody else did, and you feel really bad that somebody else did something, then, you know, I just find it, you know, to hitchhike on somebody else's back, I don't think it's the right thing to do. But I didn't feel that it was warranted. There is this feeling. I'm not one of those. I'm not a pacifist. I don't think that we would all be okay if there was no military and if there were no intelligence services. I am aware that intelligence services harm people's lives and that human rights are being violated as part of their work. Okay, I'm not trying to deny it. I'm just saying that at the end of the day, I just don't see how Israel can, or actually any country can really protect its national security without it. And, you know, when you say that you're spying on someone, it sounds very bad. But I just think that I haven't heard about any other, any better way to, for example, to stop terrorists from committing, you know, bombings than intelligence. And and I haven't heard about any country in the world yet, really. There are no countries in the world that do not have intelligence services. I think that
maybe if I just cut in there. I mean, I didn't think we were going to get so early to this because I was planning a little later to talk about the whole, you know, conflict and everything. But maybe the issue is always about, or sometimes, that those intelligence means are used, okay, in one way, but then they're used, for example, later on in the process, for example, in like administrative detentions.
Exactly. I think you're right. This is why. What's important, it's not to say, oh, let's refuse to serve in military intelligence because it's doing wrong things. I think that it's more appropriate to say we need very, very thorough scrutiny and monitoring of those intelligence services. And in my opinion, right. The problem in Israel that there's not enough oversight.
Okay.
I don't think we should shut down Unit 8200 because it's spying on people. I think we should have more oversight on what it's doing.
Okay, so we kind of sidetracked a little. I want to get back to the journalism thing because you started at Haaretz when I was there on the night desk, and you really, you know, you climbed up the ladder and you became this master of scoops until today. And it's funny because. Just yesterday when I was, you know, preparing for today's conversation, I was reading New York Times. I was doing something else instead of preparing, and I read this profile about Maggie Haberman, written by her colleague Ben Smith in the New York Times, and it kind of summed up her 4 years of this wild ride of covering, you know, the Trump presidency. And it interviewed a lot of other reporters who were basically saying how afraid they were of her bylines each morning because every day she had something, so many scoops. They even interviewed, by the way, Jonathan Swan from Axios, who you currently work with. And I thought to myself, you know, when I was reading it, I said, you know, tomorrow I'm basically going to be talking to the Israeli version of Maggie Haberman. And there's this one paragraph that I want to read to you. That and then kind of get your take on it because it just shows how she works. And Ben Smith talks about how he met her and how he worked with her first in a local paper in New York City when they were younger, you know, 10, 15 years younger. He said, first she picked up the competing newspaper, the Daily News, and leafed through for stories she wished she'd broken, deducing who had been the source of each one. Then she called the sources, she already knew them well, of course, and chatted in a friendly way before telling them she felt genuinely betrayed that they hadn't gone to her, that she was worried she'd be in trouble with her boss for getting beaten, and honestly, that she was incredibly angry at them. So, Barak, can you tell you know, aspiring journalists or jealous journalists like myself, without, of course, disclosing any, you know, secrets of your trade, because that's, you know, important. What's your method for handling sources, for maintaining that relationship? And is it similar maybe to what Maggie Haberman was just doing? You know, that was already like a decade ago, but what she probably still does to this day.
Yeah. So first, it's a huge compliment to be mentioned in the same sentence with Maggie Haberman. She's really amazing. And, you know, the fact that she was so successful, if there's one thing, is one proof of how good she is that Trump is fixated by her. You know, he's fixated by her, meaning that, you know, she killed him. In the last 4 years, she really killed him. Okay,
every day, but every day,
every day, every sometimes three times a day. Okay, sometimes three times a day. But he is still calling her and talking to her because, you know, he just I think he's just mesmerized by the fact that she's dealing with him so much, and she knows him. She knows him from before, from the time when she was working in, again, local media in New York, and he was, you know, in real estate in New York, so they've known each other for many, many years. But still, you would expect that Donald Trump would just say, you know, the hell with her. I'm not talking to her, whatever. But no.
So how do you explain that? How would you explain that relationship?
You know, I think that it shows a lot about her and how successful she is. And at the end of the day, Trump likes winners. And he understands force and power, and she's very powerful.
That's a good point.
And second, and secondly, I just think that you know, he's it also shows a lot about him, because he's and his, you know, character, that he at the end of the day wants her approval or wants to be accepted by Maggie Haberman, the New York Times. About you know, the paragraph you read and the method and the MO, I gotta tell you that it's pretty similar. I would just add that many times it's not only about seeing which stories you missed, but it's seeing which stories were published in other media outlets that they missed. Meaning, many times you see stories in other media outlets that the most interesting thing or the big lead is buried somewhere in the 10th paragraph in the last sentence. And that the person who wrote the story or the editor didn't even understand what they just bumped into. And I have many, many stories that I saw a lead somewhere in another story that the guy who wrote it didn't understand what he was doing, and I just, you know, took it from the floor and made two other phone calls, and there you have a story which is 10 times better than the original one.
Is it sometimes also just, you know, shooting in the dark, like calling someone on any given day and say, hey, you got something for me?
It's that too. But I think that at the end of the day, a lot of it is about being, you know, relevant all the time and not giving up on anything, not giving any ground. Meaning, it's not like you say, oh, okay, today I missed the story, no worries. If this is your state of mind, then very quickly you will lose your edge. It's if you want to be, you know, at the top, there are no there are no compromises, meaning if I can really understand this, what was described in the story, in Ben Smith's story, that, you know, you call the person and you tell him that you feel betrayed and that he stabbed you in the back and that you will not forget this, and there will be a time that what comes around goes around, and I got to tell you, I'm not sure I'm as charming and polite as Maggie. I think,
really?
I think I'm, and it's not, again, it works many times, but it's not, you know, I'm aware that it's something I need to work on, and I'm not sure that I'm able to change it, but I'm many times I find myself you know, being too aggressive on people to the point that, you know, it's on the one hand, it's effective because it creates a deterrence, but it's not, I don't know, sometimes on a more, let's say, moral basis, it's...
I think it sounds like very difficult because you have to find this balance between good cop and bad cop almost with every source.
I think most of the time I'm the bad cop. Mm. Most of the time I'm the bad cop.
And some of these relationships kind of like real relationships in life, they just burn up in flames, right? Because of maybe something you wrote and you're not going to hear from them ever again. You lost them.
I got to tell you that I find that there are very few people that you really lose. Mm. Most of them, you know, they get angry or you get angry at them. And, you know, sometimes it takes 2 days, sometimes it takes 2 months, sometimes it takes 2 years. At the end of the day, if you are relevant and if you project power and if you have stories and if you break scoops, then those people will have to talk to you. Okay.
Right.
Netanyahu hasn't spoken to me in a decade. Mm. Okay. One-on-one in a meeting or on the phone.
What was the trigger? What was the breaking point?
I don't even think that there was a breaking point. I just think that, you know, he was, I think a lot of it is the, a generational gap that we never managed to, you know, we never connected on a personal,
right.
In a personal way. And there was no chemistry. And he never thought, I think at the beginning, he didn't think that it was worth his time and effort. And, you know, very quickly, I think he understood that he was wrong. But I can understand why he thought so back then in 2009. But again, he's not talking to me for more than a decade, but still he has his ways that, you know, when he wants to communicate, he has his ways and the people around him do communicate with me because people, at the end of the day, if you're relevant, people will talk to you. And today, I think that especially with social media, reporters are their own brand, meaning the platform that you write or that you broadcast or that you publish, whatever, is less important than your own reputation and your own record and your own brand. And this is why it is, you know, more than ever, it is critical for reporters, in my opinion, to not to make any compromises regarding their integrity, their reputation.
But is there a price for that? I mean, because there's, you know, there's also a lot of opinions. There's a lot of, you know, stuff going. You spend a lot of time on Twitter, I notice. And I think part of, you know, building that brand is spending time on Twitter. So is that, you know, first of all, that's time consuming. Correct me if I'm wrong. Instead of, you know, maybe doing regular the journalist work. But it's also about very easy to identify, you know, who's left and who's right. And it's not as, I think, neutral as journalism used to be. Of course, it's changed all over the world like that. But do you feel there's a price for this branding?
Yes, there is a price, but I don't think it's that important. Let's say there was no Twitter, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Would it mean that the people who are writing to me on Twitter that they don't believe a word I'm writing because I'm a liberal leftist scum, I should go to Gaza? And I'm, you know, auto-anti-Semitic and all of those things. You think that they wouldn't think that? They would. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, the only thing that matters, and I say to a lot of people that criticize me, I tell them, you know, you don't like what I think, you don't like my opinions, no problem. But you should... test me, okay? The only test is whether my stories are accurate. That's it. That's the only thing that should, I think, should interest people. And everything else, every, you know, if somebody told me you got that wrong, okay, the story, the facts, not you said that something will happen and it didn't happen. We are not fortune tellers. We are not oracles that we look at this, glass ball and, you know, predict the future. Okay, we give, you know, analysis. At least 50% of the time it's wrong. But, you know, our job is to try to analyze something at a certain point, not to predict the future.
Yeah.
And by the way, all of those who say that you know, make a career out of checking which analysis we got wrong are usually not there when our analysis is right.
Mm-hmm. So after quite a career in Harris, you left for TV. How was that for you to move from print to broadcast? Did you enjoy that? Was it scary at the beginning?
It was scary. I just felt that I needed a change and to do something different. To leave Haaretz is as you know, is not an easy decision, not an easy thing to do. This is it's really the best journalism institution in the country, maybe the only one, and totally independent, totally free. Very professional, and I had a good life there, and I had a lot of friends, and it was very easy and comfortable. But I said I needed a change, so I went to television, and it was an experience. It's very, very different. Broadcast television is very different than Haaretz. In Haaretz, you compete against yourself. There's no real competition. Because mm-hmm. you deal with issues that the rest of the Israeli press usually doesn't deal with. And when you're in broadcast television, then you're in this daily duel of, you wait for 8 p.m. and you go head to head with your competition every day. And it's like, again, it's like this ceremony. It's like in medieval times, when the knights come to this arena and calls the battle and both of them start to, on their horses to run towards each other and everyone are waiting to see who falls. So yeah, it's really like that every day at 8 p.m. on broadcast television. So the competition is very, very hard. And so it was a challenge. But when I moved, it was to what was back then Channel 10, which was the most the media outlet that was most similar in its journalistic ethos and journalistic DNA to Haaretz. And I had a very good time there. I the editor in chief was Golan Yochpaz, was mm-hmm. one of the best journalists in the country, really a mentor, and I owe him a lot. And I think what we did at the time in Channel 10 was something very big, because what I try to do is to bring a kind of stories that usually you do not see on broadcast television. And I remember that there was a day, it was something that I'm most proud of. There was a day when there were the possibility of a demolition of the Bedouin village of Khan el-Ahmar in the West mm-hmm. Bank came up again. Mm-hmm. And I had a story about it, about, European protest, the prime minister's office about it. And I remember that on that day, in all the different news shows during the day, all in all together, there were like 7 minutes, 7 minutes during the day that on broadcast television about the village of Khan el-Ahmar. This is, for somebody who thinks that it's only 7 minutes, on broadcast television, 7 minutes is a lot. It's like a 1,000-word story or a 1,500-word story in a newspaper.
That's right. It's a long time.
That's big. And so this is what I try to do, to bring stories that usually people that watch broadcast television don't get to see, issues that they don't get to hear about. And you know, I did two series about the Israel's relations with the Arab world, with the Gulf. You know, at the time that it was still not, you know, today we are all experts on Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Sudan, Bahrain. Back at the time, you know, nobody was talking about this. And it was a risk for Channel 10 at the time. It was right after Channel 10 merged with Reshet to form Channel 13. And that's people were very nervous about the ratings and everything. And I understood the editors at the time that they were nervous about broadcasting the series, you know, because it was 4 episodes. Each episode was between 10 to 15 minutes about the Arab world. That's not something that you usually see on broadcast television. And we didn't know if people would be interested or not. I thought people would, because I think that at the end of the day, the viewers are intelligent and they're interested in things and they want to see other stuff. And it was quite a big success, and the ratings were very high, and I was very, very happy about it. So that's what I tried to do. Unfortunately, again, at a certain point, I think mainly after the editor-in-chief was replaced, there was a different set of priorities, editorial priorities in Channel 13. And, you know, to make a long story short, if people still don't know, I'm not working there anymore.
Yeah. I don't know how much you want to talk about it. I mean, I also remember that your colleagues tried to keep you at work. They loved you so much, and they wanted, you know, to work out some kind of payment system, or like make this fund that would keep your job still alive. But as if, I think, I don't know if that's a little misleading, as if it was a financial issue, because personally, I don't think it was just a financial issue. But maybe I'd like to hear your take on it.
Back at the time, we didn't know. They didn't know. I mean, there was because when I got the letter inviting me for a hearing, the letter said that I was one of the workers in the company with the worst results and capabilities.
Wow.
Oh my God. This is what they wrote in my letter, God. Which was you know, a bit funny. And when I came to the
just a tad.
When I came to the hearing, I prepared the list of all the stories I published in the last year. And I read it out loud in the hearing. It was like, it took like 20 minutes. And I just went, you know, one after the other. And then I also told the CEO and the editor-in-chief in the hearing that I was asked to say something for the White House, because there was a story a day before my hearing, or 2 days before the hearing, there was a story on AP about that, you know, they did a story about the fact that I was going to be fired. So people at the White House saw it and called me and said that they saw that I was invited for a hearing, and they said, can you say something, you know, in our name? I said, are you sure that you want me, you know, it's pretty unconventional. And said, yes, we really want you to say. I said, okay, what do you want me to say? You should tell them in the hearing that it was back then, there was the main story was the possibility of Israeli annexation. So they said, you should tell them that now with the whole annexation thing, we were thinking about doing an interview for the president in the Israeli press, and we wanted it to give it to you. So you should tell them that now, unfortunately, we'll not be able to do the interview on Channel 13. And I said, are you sure that you want me to tell them that? I said, yes, he says, we are definitely sure we want to. and no problem. I said, oh, you know, it might be leaked. No problem, no problem. Tell them we have no problem. And I said it in the hearing as part of the long list of things that, you know, professionally, that I did professionally in the last year. And they just didn't care. They, there was no, you know, you would think that at least somebody would be, you know, curious to, you know, to hear more. So that they were totally silent. Like,
And the
head of our union, the workers' union, Matan Khodorov, told them.
Was a brilliant reporter in his own right.
Yes, brilliant
financial reporter. Yeah, go
brilliant
ahead.
Brilliant reporter and a good friend. And he told them, well, you just heard this long list and this thing about the White House and the interview with Trump. So obviously, this doesn't coincide with what you wrote in the letter, that he's one of the workers with the worst capabilities and results. So what's the reason? If it's an economic reason, you know, budget cuts, you know, let's find a way to do it. The workers agreed to, you know, donate some of their salaries. Maybe, you know, Barack will cut his own salary, and maybe we can find a solution. They stayed silent. They didn't say anything about that. So when they stayed silent, so Matan said in the hearing, told them to the CEO and the editor-in-chief, he told them, well, if it's not professional, and if it's not economic, then there might be a third reason that you're not saying. So you should come forward, or there will be a very big question mark above this decision. And they didn't say anything. And I think that until today, there is a big, big, big question mark above this decision. And I saw... there was a big. I got a lot of support from
many people
who used to watch me on Channel 13 and on social media and I think
a lot of people like me, by the way, were just angry.
Yeah, that's a lot of the reactions I got, that people were angry, and again, I think it would be a question mark that. One day, I think we'll get the answers for it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it will be when the people responsible will speak publicly. I don't know if it will be as part of a police investigation. I don't know if it will be in another way. But I think that, you know, this way or another, things will be.
Why do you think it could be part of a police investigation, Barack?
No, I'm just, again, it's not that I think that there was something criminal. I'm just saying that in the last few years, we saw that
there were
police investigations that had to do with interventions by politicians in the media. I'm not saying that this is the case. I'm just saying that this way or another, I think we will get an answer for it. But again, luckily, I managed very quickly to find a new place of work at Walla News, and they were very kind to me. And there are a group of great professionals there. And I also think that many of the people who used to follow me and watch me on Channel 13 today do the same thing on Walla. And I'm grateful for it. And I think that on Walla too, the timing was very, very good because I joined Walla a week before the announcement of the surprise announcement of the normalization deal
between
Israel and the UAE. And we had on Walla the first ever interview with the Minister of State for Foreign Affairs in the UAE, first interview by a UAE official with the Israeli press. And this is something I was very, very proud about.
Good. Yeah. I mean, you did, of course, Channel 13, in my opinion, made a big mistake, and that's Walla's gain. Good for them. And you know, I totally sympathize as someone also who has recently been, you know, pushed out of non-professional reasons. But let's end it with that. I mean, let's talk about the news that you just mentioned. Let's put on your analysis hat. And before we discuss the elections, Barack, and a future most probable Biden presidency, can we try and analyze Trump's legacy? I don't know. I'm even afraid to use that word. Do you think he has a legacy in this region after 4 years?
No, of course he has a legacy. There's no doubt. One part of this legacy is the to continue the trend of pulling out of the region. That's no doubt. The U.S.
He hasn't completely pulled out though. I mean,
he hasn't completely pulled out. But the trend, he continued this trend. And by the way, if it was only up to him, he would have pulled out all the troops from Syria. He would have pulled out all the troops from Afghanistan, from Iraq, he would go all the way. So I think this is one legacy that some people would say that he just continued Obama's legacy of, you know, pulling out of the region. And I think that the Abraham Accords, even though the way it happened, again, it wasn't, I don't think, or at least from everything I know, it wasn't part of a big master plan that ended up with those normalization deals. It was a long set of eclectic steps in the same direction, okay, of getting the Israel and the Arab world closer together, the pressure on Iran, the sidelining of the Palestinian issue, the strengthening relations with Saudi Arabia after, you know, a cool period with Obama. All of those trends, Trump, I think, in a series of steps that were not necessarily connected and part of a, you know, big strategy, you know, now in retrospect, or, you know, you build a strategy around it. But I think Trump created the atmosphere and the environment that allowed this thing to happen. And I think that you should be also, I always tell it to a lot of people that there's a very famous Israeli football player called Alon Mizrahi. He's the football player that scored the biggest number of goals ever in the history of the Israeli Football League. And he wasn't like the football player with the best technique or super intelligent or super sophisticated or super strong or whatever. He was quite mediocre. But he had one important thing. He was in the right place at the right time. And a lot of his goals were him standing on the 5-meter line, the ball, hitting him and getting into the between the goalposts,
bouncing off his knee.
Yeah. So again, I'm not saying it to disrespect him. I'm saying this because in politics, as in football, it's important to be in the right place at the right time.
What do you say to those that critique that comes mostly from the left, saying, you know, these? I'm talking about the Abraham Accords, okay? Specifically, that these are just weapons deals with the U.S. And formalizing, business contacts that are already
deals between tycoons, between elites.
Yeah. What's your?
That do not reflect the people. That there was, in any case, there were relations for many years. So what's the difference? Look, it's very sad. I got to tell you, I find it very sad. It's almost a cliche the way, you know, people on the left reacted. It's like, you know, I just, you know, the amount of conspiracy theories around those deals, that it's only deals that their goal is to make Trump, Bibi, Mohammed bin Zayed and Jared Kushner, to make them richer, okay? That there's, you know, all sorts of conspiracy theories. At the end of the day, you know, if you like Trump or not, if you like Bibi or not, you need to give them credit for, you know, being in the right place at the right time, taking this opportunity in both hands and going for it. Because Netanyahu,
what do you say? Yeah, well, what's your answer to the Palestinians who say, you know, they feel like they've been betrayed or thrown under the bus by their Arab brothers?
I'll refer to that in a second. I just want to add one thing.
Okay.
At the end of the day, Netanyahu was on a path for some sort of annexation in the West Bank. Okay? He wanted to do it. It was not a spin. Really, it was not a spin. That was his action plan. And at a certain point, at the beginning of July, he was faced with two options: whether to continue on the path of annexation and try to squeeze something out of Trump. And I believe that if he wanted to do it, he would have gotten something. Okay? Maybe not the whole 30% of the West Bank, but he could have gotten something. Or on the other hand, to, you know, take annexation off the table, to kill this idea, an idea that he ran on in three election campaigns, to put it aside and go for a normalization agreement with the UAE. It's not an easy decision. Usually Netanyahu, when he faced a crossroads and he needed to pick his political survival and his base or the national interest, in really 9 out of 10 times he picked his own political survival and his base. In this case, he picked the national interest. So you got to give him credit. You can't just say that it's all one big spin. It's not. And for the as far as the Palestinians go, look, there the Palestinians are in a deep, deep, deep crisis. A crisis of the Palestinian national movement that, you know, also has to do with Israel, but in big part it has to do with internal Palestinian things. I told the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shteya, I met him it was February, I think, in Munich at the security conference. And I told him that the Palestinian situation right now is very similar to the Palestinian situation in the late 1930s and the 1940s, where the Palestinians made a mistake by going for the, you know, big rebellion against the Brits. They were internally divided. They put their faith in the Arab world that was just using them. They were not pragmatic diplomatically. They didn't understand what's going on in the world after World War II. They didn't understand the world has changed, and they took a long list of wrong decisions that got them to the Nakba in 1948. Mm-hmm. Israel was part of it, okay? I'm not taking Israel out of this equation. It was part of it. But a lot of it was Palestinian internal divisions and policy mistakes. And unfortunately, the same thing is happening today. This divide between the West Bank and Gaza, between Fatah and Hamas, that is just destroying the Palestinian national movement without, you know, reordering of the Palestinian politics, the Palestinian national movement will die. It's dying right now. Mm-hmm. And this boycott by the Palestinians on the Trump administration didn't get them anywhere. Okay. So luckily for them, Trump lost the elections, but if he won, that's it for them. Okay? Right. They were very close to a second Nakba.
So, you know, I've seen this question going around a lot, and I wonder what your answer is to it. Was Trump good for Israel or good for Netanyahu?
Well, I think I'm trying to do a more complex analysis of Trump's legacy. I think that... Yeah. In some things, he was good for Israel. In some things, he was bad for Israel. In some things, he was good for Netanyahu. You know,
like the Abraham Accords that you think, okay.
Yeah, I think that the Abraham Accords were very good for Israel. I think that, on the other hand, the fact that he took a set of decisions right before three election campaigns were very good for Netanyahu and very bad for Israel, because it made Israel a political issue in America, and it made America a political issue in Israel. This is very bad.
Okay, let's move on to Biden. From what you know, is Netanyahu worried about this at all?
Well, I know that Netanyahu would have preferred Trump. That's obvious. So that's not saying much. And I think he's concerned about, again, first, the change of style. For Netanyahu to have a U.S. ambassador like David Friedman here that was basically, you know, working for him. And this is something that, you know, it's a dream for any Israeli prime minister. So just, you know, the fact that there will be here an ambassador that is not, you know, enabling you every step of the way and not giving you support in everything you do, including in domestic politics, this would be a disadvantage. After again,
yeah, I wonder that you bring up domestic politics, because I wonder, could one argue that, you know, politically, domestically, maybe it's good for him saying that, you know, look up to me, look at me, how I stood up to Obama for 8 years. You'll need me now again to stand up against, you know, in front of Biden, and, you know, they'll all coalesce and rally around.
Yeah, I'm sure.
A man who has experience.
I'm sure he will say that, but his problem is that Biden is more like Bill Clinton, meaning it's harder to say that Bill Clinton is anti-Israeli. And also, it's harder to say that Joe Biden is anti-Israeli. I think that the fact that it was very easy for Netanyahu to portray Obama as anti-Israel has to do with racist trends in Israel. I think that the fact that, you know, Obama's middle name was Hussein had to do with it. I think the fact that Obama was African-American had to do with it. So I think that Netanyahu utilized racist trends in the Israeli society to basically write off Obama. And it will be harder to do with, you know, Joe Biden, even if just for those reasons. Okay.
But what if Joe Biden tries to, you know, go back into the JCPOA? Would you expect to see the same kind of fierce battle from Netanyahu, no matter what?
Yes. You know, people don't change at the age of 71. Really? And there's no reason to think it will be any different. And by the way, in Netanyahu's head, the way he dealt with the Iran deal during the Obama administration, he thinks it was a success.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, he thinks that, oh, you see, I managed to, you know, get Trump to withdraw from the deal. Obviously, he doesn't see any contradiction between that and between the fact that Iran shortened the period of time it needs in order to get enough of fissile material to get one nuclear bomb. Okay, that's he doesn't see the contradiction. But in any case, I think he will, on the Iran issue and on other issues, even though Biden has a different style from Obama and Biden is not Obama and all of that is true, at the end of the day, Netanyahu is the same Netanyahu. And I asked one of, you know, and I told one of Biden's people that who asked me this same question you're asking, I told him, why does the scorpion bite? Okay. And he does it because it's his nature. And I think that with Netanyahu, when you ask the question, why would he fight with Biden? I think it's because it's his nature.
What advice would you give Biden and the Biden administration on the Israeli-Palestinian issue to do differently than what all of the predecessors have done and basically failed on, you know, before?
What I already told them is that they should sit down with Jared Kushner and Avi Berkowitz, who ran this file for the last 4 years, and listen to what they have to say and read their papers and sit with them for several hours and ask questions and get the whole, all, every bit of information about what they did with Israel and the Arab world and the Palestinians for the last 4 years. Because there are a lot of things that they can learn and a lot of infrastructure that Kushner and Berkowitz built that they can use to continue this process of the Abraham Accords. And I think that they should learn from Obama's mistakes and from Trump's mistakes, which was the same mistake. What Obama did was that he said, okay, what I'm going to do different than Bush is that I'm going to put all the onus on the Israelis, all the pressure on Netanyahu, and this way I will get progress. It worked on some things, but overall it didn't work because he gave a free ride to the Palestinians and to Abu Mazen. Then came Trump and said, oh, I'm going to do the opposite. And he gave a free ride to Netanyahu, more than a free ride. He enabled everything he wanted to do, okay, and even gave him ideas of his own and put all the pressure on the Palestinians. That also did not lead to anything. And unfortunately, on this issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, both sides are the detractors. And if you want to get any progress here, you need to press both sides at the same time, at the same way, and you need to get a deal that both of them hate. And only when you see a U.S. president putting a deal on the table that both the Israeli prime minister and the Palestinian president say, we don't like it, then you know it's a jackpot.
You've been covering Netanyahu now for many years. You know, maybe besides Angela Merkel lengthwise, not many countries have that kind of leader around for so long. And so does that as a reporter, as a journalist, you know, frustrate you? Do you ever feel like, I need a change, someone new, it's getting old? Or do you feel like you know him already so well that you predict his move? Or does Netanyahu still surprise you?
No, first, he does surprise. And the Abraham Accords are a testament to the fact that, you know, you can still expect the unexpected from Netanyahu. And I say that as a good thing for him. So he's not totally stale and predictable. Look, that he's part of a set of leaders that have the ability to stay in power. By the way, part of it is because he manages to use the flaws of the Israeli political system. And over the years, he became, you know, really the most experienced and the most seasoned politician around. So when you put him next to Benny Gantz, who really is, when you do the most basic comparison between Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, Netanyahu is much more, he's a much deeper person, meaning he has he has worldview, he has convictions.
I just think he's smarter, period.
It's not only that, he's more well-read, he's more well-educated, that's part of it. You know, you can't take from Netanyahu the fact that he reads books, a lot of books. And I want my leader to be a well-read person. Yeah. That's I think it's a virtue. And even though it's a small thing and it would seem to people like an anecdote, it's not an anecdote. It's something that shows whether the person who's running the country is someone with a, you know, wide look on things and a worldview. And Netanyahu is someone who can talk with you about history, medicine, economy, international affairs, and popular culture. And I think that it shows that he's just much, you know, more talented. Maybe talented, that's the word, not smarter. He's more talented And I think it's it shows. And when you add to that such an experience of, you know, 30 years in public life, almost 15 years as prime minister, when you add all that together, it's very hard for anybody to run against you in elections and win. Okay, it's mainly for you to lose.
Do you see anyone who's capable on the left, at least?
I don't see
any kind of.
I don't see anybody who can really challenge Netanyahu in a head-to-head race. Mm-hmm. But luckily, there are parts of the Israeli political system that work in the favor of Netanyahu's opponents, meaning at the end of the day, it's not about who won the biggest number of votes. This is not how it works. It's a parliamentary system here.
Yeah,
you need to get a coalition. So it doesn't matter if Netanyahu gets, if the Likud has 59 seats in the Knesset, but doesn't have another two members of Knesset to form a coalition with. So
That's right.
Really doesn't matter. It's in a way, it's like it really didn't matter that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote in 2016. It might, morally, how come that she gets more votes and she's not the president? Because it's not the system. So, and Netanyahu, in three consecutive election campaigns, did not get to 61.
That's right. But he formed a coalition. Yeah.
So the question is not whether there's someone who can challenge him in a head-to-head race. The question is whether he can get to 61. And if he won't get to 61 in the next elections, he's not going to be the prime minister.
But there are some pundits out there who are saying that Netanyahu is going to end up in jail, because of all these bribery cases. What's your prediction?
I think he's on track to go to jail. That's without passing some sort of a law to cancel his trial, which is something that he's aiming for. This is why he wants to get to 61, to fire the attorney general and cancel his trial, which, by the way, I think that if he does that, this would lead to a civil war in this country. This is a red line that if it will be crossed, people will go to the street and start burning stuff. It's not a joke. It's not, he'll do it and then people will be okay. People will not be okay. People will not be okay. And by the way, I'm really not sure that he'll be able to get to 61 for canceling his trial. It's
interesting.
And I don't think he can get to that. So at the end of the day, I think he's sooner or later, possibly later, it will take another 2-3 years. But I don't see that without some sort of a plea bargain, I don't see how he can avoid jail time.
Okay. Wow. So look, we're going to end this with the podcast question. This is the question that I ask everyone who comes on the podcast. It's the exact same question. It's got like two parts to it. But you know how the tagline of the podcast of Otherwise Occupied is to talk to anyone and everyone between the river and the sea. And seeing how as most experts say that in the 12 to 13 million people that are living here, it's about a ratio of 50% Jews and 50% non-Jews. If I gave you a magic wand that you could just, make your wish come true tomorrow, Barak, how would you want to see tomorrow that region between the river and the sea, if it's one entity, two, three, four, whatever you want? And the second part of the question is not your dream. It's more, put back your reporter, your an analytical hat, and say what you think in reality is going to happen in the next, 10, 20, 30 years.
I think, again, my personal, wish is that there will be a two-state solution, along the really generally agreed parameters of 1967 lies plus swaps, Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, security arrangements, all, you know, all this jazz. That's my dream. Okay. And that it would lead to peace. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen. I think that in the next 10 to 20 years, we will see, deepening of the occupation and the reality that is, I think we're already there in some aspects of a one-state reality.
Yeah. So it's basically like a one state outcome, basically, eventually, because nothing, that's the trajectory, that's where it's going.
Yes. And I think that, again, at least at the beginning, it will be an apartheid system. Hopefully, and this is what I'm telling a lot of people who support annexation, and then I say, okay, I understand that we're not going to have a two-state solution, and I'm going to support annexation of the entire West Bank, but there's one condition: give equal rights to everybody. If you say that, I'm voting for you. And then things start to get more complicated and nuanced, and they say, but, and we don't know. So I think that the beginning, we will have a one-state reality with also a non-official apartheid system that, over the years, whether in a civilian struggle through the courts, through the through the Knesset, through other through demonstrations in the streets, it will change over time, and then hopefully it will be a one state with equal rights. And again, I'm not saying this because this is what I want to happen. I want two states.
So you think will happen? Yeah.
But
you I think a lot of people think that the two-state solution is that train has left the station.
So again, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But I don't think that my wish about how the conflict is going to end is very real. I think unfortunately the one-state solution is more real, and I just hope that once it happens, eventually it will also be one state with equal rights to all.
Okay, Barak, on those words, we're going to have to end it. I want to really thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Ami, for having me.
Coming on the podcast, and I wish everybody in this pandemic, first of all, be safe, stay healthy, and to you and your family and your friends. So thanks a lot. I really appreciate coming on the show.
Thank you. Toda raba.
That was Barak Ravid. Thanks for listening, guys. If you want to help out, please share the post on social media or send it by email to others. Go to Apple Podcasts and give me a very nice review. And even better, consider a donation at the website, amikaufman.com, where you can also catch all the other episodes for free. See you next week. Bye-bye.